Good evening. My name is Doris Lill, and I'm the Senior Manager of Programs and Services at the National MS Society. I want to thank you for joining us on today's webinar, Gender Differences in MS. Following the presentation, there will be time for question and answer. I am monitoring your chat questions, so please make sure to post any questions that you have in the chat feature. We will also open up the phone lines and do operator-assisted questions at the end. Today's presentation is also being recorded and will be available on our website. Let me briefly introduce today's presenters. Dr. Rhonda Vossel is a professor in the Department of Neurology and director of the MS program at the UCLA School of Medicine. Dr. Barbara Geischer is the clinical director at the UCLA School of Medicine MS program. Thank you so much both for joining us this evening. Dr. Vossel, let's go ahead and get started.
Hello, thank you all for joining today. We're looking forward to discussing gender differences in MS. And my portion of the presentation will focus on an approach that's somewhat unique in the sense that it's not bench-to-bedside research, it's bedside-to-bench-to-bedside research, going from MS to the most widely used model, EAE, and back to MS in the form of clinical trials. These are the disclosures from the many investigators that we've collaborated with over the years. So to begin, what do I mean by this bench-to-bedside approach? This is the approach that has been done by many in the field in the past. It generally starts with a novel molecule or a cutting-edge technique that's very exciting, and attempts are made to take these to clinical trials. But one of the obstacles or problems with this approach is that there is a lot of redundancy in the biological systems in people, and people are very different, so there's heterogeneity of genes and other molecules. So oftentimes these approaches are not physiologically relevant or important in an MS patient. They may appear to be important in a test tube or so forth in the lab, but they don't end up being important clinically to people with the disease. Because of this problem, of course, many drug companies have a very low hit rate. When they come up with a new molecule or a new treatment, they'll screen 1,000, then it'll go down to 100 or 10, and then ultimately maybe only one that will succeed in trials. So to fix this problem, we've actually taken a different approach, and that is to start at the bedside. So instead of starting at the laboratory bench with a molecule or a technique, we actually start with a known clinical observation that is definitely true in MS patients. We then try to take that to the laboratory and figure it out at the laboratory bench. And based on those findings, we then take it back to the bedside in the form of a clinical trial, testing that new treatment. We feel like this is a way to remove a lot of the risk of following things that might not be relevant to the human condition and focus only on those things that are really important to MS patients. To that end, we focused on a couple important differences that are known to occur. One is that pregnancy is known to be associated with decreased relapses in MS. Another area of interest is that there are sex differences in MS. It's known that females are more susceptible to MS, but when males get the disease, they tend to have more severe disease or disability progression. So we feel like these are very important clinical observations that should really serve as the cornerstone for all of our basic lab research. I'll walk you through a couple of those examples of what we've done. With respect to pregnancy and the fact that it makes MS better, these are the data, and these are very nicely done by a French group in the New England Journal of Medicine. This landmark study showed that relapse rates are reduced by over 70% in the third trimester of pregnancy, better than any drug that currently exists for MS today. The reason for that could be a variety of factors, including sex hormones, of which there could be estradiol, the classic estrogen, or progesterone, or estriol. Estrogen unique to pregnancy. So any of these could have been responsible for this reduction in relapses late in the disease, since all of these hormones go to very high levels late in the pregnancy. So again, to repeat, third trimester of pregnancy, there's a dramatic reduction in relapses, and with that, there's a dramatic increase in these three hormones. So the question was, could these three hormones, one of them or all of them, be causing this decrease in relapses? It's kind of complicated, though, when you think about it, because the two estrogens, they bind to a lot of receptors on all of these cells of interest. So there's estrogen receptor alpha and beta. and they exist on T cells and macrophages, things you've heard about before with the inflammation in MS. They also exist on neurons and myelin-forming cells of the brain. So these receptors are expressed widely in the immune system and in the central nervous system. So how can we figure out whether estriol or estradiol could be protective in the disease? One thing to keep in mind is that one of them is much safer. So estriol is a very safe estrogen, even safer than the estrogens used in birth control pills or hormone replacement therapy. One of the reasons for that could be because it's relatively weak compared to estradiol, and also it binds to this estrogen receptor beta more than alpha, with alpha mediating bad effects on breast or uterus. So we pursued estriol because it was safe, and we thought, and it was a pregnancy estrogen. What we found was, using the animal model, the most widely used animal model for MS, we found, as shown in this graph, of mice with EAE, experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis, these mice, the orange line shows a score of 4, which is complete paralysis. Score of 3 would be partial paralysis. 2 is no paralysis, but inability to prevent someone from turning them over. And 1 is just a limp tail. Otherwise, they're totally normal with their walking ability. And as you can see, when we treated mice with this MS model, we had a dramatic reduction in their disability, their walking ability. They could walk almost normally with the estriol treatment. And incidentally, we did use estriol at a dose that would give them a normal pregnancy level. We then went on to show that it wasn't merely walking that was improved, but also their spinal cord had less inflammation, spared axons, and spared myelin. Other groups showed this as well, several groups around the world. So this is very exciting. We then wanted to ask, could estrogens be not only anti-inflammatory, which would be a lot like the drugs we have available today, or could they be directly neuroprotective? In other words, could they be affecting cells in the brain as well as suppressing the immune system? And what we found with the way that we did this was we knocked out an estrogen receptor only on a brain cell of interest, and we asked, do we still see the effect or not? If you lose the effect by knocking the receptor out of a brain cell, then it has to be acting on that brain cell. So to summarize a lot of work that we've done, we've shown that estriol, again the pregnancy estrogen, given at a level that is like pregnancy, is not only anti-inflammatory like many of the other drugs that already exist, and that would be good because it would decrease inflammation in the brain, but in addition to that, by using these knockouts of these receptors in these brain cells, we showed that estriol is also directly neuroprotective. So not merely anti-inflammatory, but it goes into the brain and protects these cells by binding receptors on them. So moving on now to our clinical work. The first thing we did was we did a pilot clinical trial giving estriol for the first time at a pregnancy level to women with MS. It was a small pilot trial with 10 women, and we compared pretreatment to treatment. What we found was there was a 70 to 80% reduction in the gadolinium-enhancing lesions in the brain. These are the inflammatory lesions. We also saw beneficial effects in peripheral blood immune responses. So the next thing we did was to go to a larger, longer study. And this time, instead of using a biomarker, which is commonly used in small initial trials, such as MRIs or immune responses, in this case, we used a clinical outcome, with that clinical outcome being relapse rate. And relapse rates are a very important clinical outcome. Of course, all the drugs approved so far in MS use relapse rates as their outcome for FDA approval. So our trial, which was funded by the NIH and the National MS Society and was initiated by investigators and by academics, had funding to support a size of trial that was about 158 patients. It was 16 sites across the United States. And this time we're going to treat people for 2 years or 24 months, and we're going to look at relapses as the primary outcome measure. Now, since we were treating them for 24 months, all of them were treated with standard of care for MS, namely Copaxone, because it wouldn't be good to have relapsing patients treated with placebo only. So what we did then is basically we added on estriol or placebo to people who had all started Copaxone, all standard of care. And the significance value was p equals 0.1 since it was a phase 2 trial, not a phase 3 trial. The sites that were involved are shown, and these were excellent sites from around the country, including, of course, UCLA, but well-known principal investigators from around the country that some of you may have worked with or seen in the clinic. Our results from this trial, which have been presented in abstract form with the paper now being submitted, were the following. The primary outcome measure was a reduction in relapse rates. We had hoped to reduce relapses by a third over 24 months. As you see in this slide, we did indeed, in the red bar compared to the black bar, reduce relapses by 32% with a p-value of 0.077 at 24 months. This is, again, comparing estriol plus GA or Copaxone versus placebo plus GA or Copaxone in black. Even more interestingly was the fact that the effect occurred very early. So after only 12 months, we had seen this marked effect of estriol plus GA in red as compared to placebo plus GA in black, 0.48 to 0.25 for a 47% reduction within just 12 months. Interestingly, after 12 months, the relapse rates were very low, enhancing lesions were very low, and so they stayed low at 24 months. And as you see, the Copaxone took a little bit of time to work. It went down some between month 12 to 24. So we hit our primary outcome measure, which was very exciting. As I said, we're very interested in the bedside and clinical observations, and so during this time, it was noted that healthy women undergo cognitive decline when they have estrogen removed. And when estrogen is given back, their cognition improves. So, again, cognitive decline is associated with estrogen withdrawal, and cognitive improvement is associated with administering estrogen in healthy women. This could be relevant to MS as well, of course, since MS patients have cognitive decline. The other element at the preclinical laboratory level was that it was shown that when estrogens are taken away from rats or mice, they have cognitive decline, and when they're given back, they have cognitive improvement. So we next went to the MS, back to the MS model, EAE, which I talked about before, and instead of measuring the usual things like walking in EAE, we actually measured an area of the brain known to be associated with cognition. It's called the hippocampus, and as you can see in this figure on the left in A, this is the normal hippocampus, and in B, this is the thinning of this area of the hippocampus that's important for cognition. And in C, you can see what happens in EAE, the disease, when we add estriol back. And this is quantified on the right in the color graphs. But the bottom line is we showed that in EAE, you also get cognitive decline, and it's associated with atrophy of this area. And then when you treat with estriol, the pregnancy estrogen, it improves it. We then went further in EAE to show that one of the ways it's improving it is it's causing synapses to be brought back. So what do I mean by that? Well, synapses are the connections that occur between neurons or electrical impulses. They're the endpoints that make contact. And as you can see, the normal on the left, the synapses are in red on the left and then dark dots on the right. When you go to EAE, these are decreased. And this is known now in MS as well as EAE that you have loss of these synapses or these connections between the axons. What you find when you treat with estriol is the synapses come back. They come back significantly, as shown on the right, with EAE plus E. This was then shown to be functionally significant. When we stimulated, we did electrophysiologic studies, and we stimulated and we recorded, and we found that, again, EAE had deficits. When you stimulate and you record, there was less function, and then we added estriol. These things came back. So now with all of this interesting data in other healthy women, healthy mice and rats, and then in EAE, the animal model, we said, what happened in our trial with respect to cognition? And we were pleasantly surprised to find that when we had treated, again, back to our trial with placebo plus GA in black and estriol plus GA in red, we found that when we looked at all patients, indeed there was an improvement. This was the one-year data. Within 1 year, we had seen a significant improvement with estriol as an add-on compared to placebo. This is under all. We then split that data from the trial into patients who scored less than or greater than 55 on this test. It's called the PASAT. Well, 55 is a really good score because the maximum score is 60. And so what we found was that when people were scoring greater than 55 over on the right, they were scoring between 55 and 60. They did well, and they continued to do well, and there was no effect. Where this dramatic effect was found was in the patients who were scoring less than 55. So people who were scoring poorly on the test at baseline, when they got estriol in combination with GA or Copaxone, they had a significant improvement. Now, this is important because most drugs with MS, we talk about their effect in slowing disability accumulation, preventing bad things from happening. This is evidence that we're getting improvement. So a disability is getting better, not just slowing its ability, not slowing its rate of decline, but causing it to improve. And again, if you think about what we found in the preclinical model, we think it's because of bringing back synapses or these connections. Now, I'll move on to another clinical observation. So that's how we took the pregnancy issue from the bedside to the bench to the bedside. But what about this other clinical observation I talked about? Well, females are more susceptible than males. It's about 3-to-1, females to males. This could actually be due to either sex hormones or sex chromosomes. Let's talk about hormones first. It's interesting with hormones that men have lower testosterone levels than healthy men. There's a wide range, about 300 to 900 is the normal range. And MS men live at about 350 to 450, so they have a low normal range. Well, we were wondering about that. Could it be that testosterone is protected, but then when it drops to a lower level as men get a little bit older with MS, maybe this is one of the reasons they come down with MS eventually. So we did all of these EAE studies, these preclinical MS studies, and we showed that, indeed, when you castrate male mice, the disease is worse. When you give testosterone, it's better. And on top of that, when you look at the blood, they have immune modulation. And when you look at the spinal cords, they have, with testosterone treatment, they have less inflammation. And they spare myelin and they spare axons. So there's now been a lot of work done by many groups around the world showing that testosterone treatment of the preclinical model of MS is beneficial. So what did we do? We went back to the bedside in the form of a clinical trial again. This particular clinical trial, again, started small, where we have 10 men with MS, and they are going to be treated with testosterone. What we're going to try to do with our testosterone treatment, in this case we used Androgel, which has been widely used for older men to prevent cognitive decline, to improve fatigue, to improve sexual function, and et cetera. So we used a type of a testosterone and a dose that had been widely used and known to be safe. And what we did was we treated MS men with this dose. It was rubbed on it's a gel that they rubbed on their shoulders each day. You can see what we did to their testosterone levels. In the dark black line is the testosterone levels without supplementation. And then the one with the boxes that are open, the white boxes, are when they got treated. So what we did when we treated them was to boost their level from a low normal level to a high normal level by giving them Androgel every day. Now, the duration of treatment that we used was that there was a 6-month pre-treatment period. That's the 0 to minus 5 on the bottom, 0 to minus 5 months. There's 6 months pre-treatment followed by 12 months of treatment, 12 months of treatment with testosterone. What we found was that we slowed brain atrophy. And so the brain atrophy is shown, actually I'll go back to this slide. The brain atrophy rate is shown here, pre-treatment. The slope is going down and then it curves to where it begins to stabilize. Actually it goes from a rate of an MS rate of atrophy to a rate of normal aging. That's what we did with testosterone treatment, looking at whole brain. The next thing that we did was we looked at slowing atrophy rates voxel-wise, or each part of the brain, to see where did this atrophy improvement occur. And as you can see in the pretreatment time, there was, in blue, there was a lot of atrophy that was occurring, and then by 6 months of treatment, it was going away, and by the last 12 months, 6 months of treatment, or the full 12 months, it was completely gone. And indeed, there was one area of hope that there was some reestablishment of this brain volume with late treatment, so getting back function or getting back brain volume. Just to finish this up, we then, of course, had heard that testosterone is good for older men and their cognition, and so we went back to the MS model called EAE, and we showed the same thing was happening with these synapses, where in green you see the synapses in these normal mice, and then in the EAE model in the middle in B, you see the synapses are lost or reduced dramatically, and then when you treat with testosterone in male mice with the MS model, again, these synapses come back. We then also confirmed this with electrophysiologic studies as stated before. Now, by the way, this is not surprising because it's known that testosterone is converted to estrogen in the brain. So it's not that surprising that estriol in women or testosterone in men would do somewhat of the same thing. So last but not least, we then designed a trial that was the next sort of a big trial across the United States. This was 25 sites across the United States, and it was to do the same thing we'd done with estriol in women, and that was to give testosterone to men with MS, and it would be 110 men across the United States, and they'd be treated with either testosterone or placebo. We had everything on board with the NIH NeuroNext infrastructure, which was very exciting, but then when it was sent to the NIH for funding, it was not funded. So we were very disappointed, and if you are interested in this, maybe you can promote this through the MS Society. This is what happened with the estriol trial as well. We had a lot of trouble getting it funded, but the MS Society really stepped up and ushered this through. So hopefully we can find a way for testosterone to be pursued further in men with MS. I think many men with MS would like to know if their testosterone could help their disease. Some of them want to take it anyway for fatigue and muscle loss and so forth. So we would like to do the real basic science on testosterone and find out whether we can actually help the disease or not with them. So I'm going to have to end here because I'm running out of time, but I do want to say that we've done a tremendous amount of work also looking at why men do worse. So men are less likely to get MS. That's true. But when they get it, they have worse progression. We think one of the reasons they have worse progression, long story short, is because we are looking at X chromosome and Y chromosome genetic effects, and that the sex chromosome genetics are going to be why the male brain responds with more neurodegeneration and disability accumulation during this immune attack of MS. And so I will go ahead and stop there in the interest of time and not get into our genetic studies. Let me just finish off, though. My summary slide of all this is that I hope you've seen how we have gone from bedside intervention to bedside, MS to EAE back to MS, showing that with pregnancy, reducing relapses, this has actually led to estriol as a potential treatment for women with MS. One more trial needs to be done, which would be a phase 3. The second thing about why men are less likely to get MS, it has led us to testosterone treatment for males with MS, and then we're all further pursuing these genetic studies to look for why men might have more disability. And to tie this in with the NIH mission that was recently published in Nature by Francis Collins and Jeanine Clayton, our work was heavily referenced for examples on how important it really is to study gender differences in disease, because they can tell you new hints or clues that could turn into new treatments. So again, my view is I think it's best to start all this basic research at the bench, actually to start it early and start at the bedside with clinical observations if you want to increase your likelihood of success of something in clinical trials. And so just to acknowledge, these are my clinical and basic science collaborators that I work with. Importantly, the many graduate students and undergrads at UCLA who are extremely important for this work. And, of course, funding by the NIH National MS Society, the Hilton Foundation, the Skirball Foundation, and the Sherrick Family Foundation. And thank you for your interest and support. And I'll turn it over to our moderator and to Dr. Geiser.
Okay. This is Barbara Geiser, and Dr. Vasco's done a beautiful job of setting up the sort of clinical applications of her very exciting research and the trials that she's conducted. And I spend most of my time seeing people with MS. And so what I'd like to cover in my portion of the talk is some of the questions that clinicians commonly get asked about what are the effects of gender on MS. And we get asked, when somebody with MS becomes pregnant, how do you manage that person? What about hormones that people take in clinical use, such as birth control pills and hormone replacement for people having menopause? And what does happen to women with MS at menopause? Both men and women who have MS can get sexual dysfunction, and we ought to talk a little bit about that. And then there are just general health issues that both sexes should think about. So some of the frequently asked questions we get are what type of birth control should I use or not use? What do I do about my disease-modifying therapy if I become pregnant? What happens if I get an MS attack when I become pregnant? What will the effect of pregnancy be on my MS down the line? And what is the risk for my baby getting MS? So we'll start out with talking about what happens for people who don't become pregnant because they're taking birth control And we have actually several decades of studies looking at the effects of oral contraceptives on MS, and these studies are kind of mixed. The older studies had oral contraceptives that used much different, much higher doses of hormones than we use today. But most of those studies show that there was either no risk of oral contraceptives increasing the risk of MS or maybe even having a slightly decreased risk of getting MS. There's one small study that says, well, no, maybe women who have MS who take birth control pills have a slightly increased risk, but that's only one study, and I'm not sure we can draw any frank conclusions from that. So right now we have no data that say that oral contraceptives are bad for MS or good. They're probably neutral, although, again, as Dr. Voskel told us, estrogens may in fact have a salutary effect on MS. In terms of non-hormonal methods of birth control, barrier methods such as gels or diaphragms, if you have some decreased coordination or some decreased sensation, it may be hard for you to actually use those methods. And lastly, other drugs that people may take for other conditions or to control some of the symptoms of MS could interfere with oral contraceptives. So this is a discussion that you want to have with your gynecologist. People have sort of been interested in MS and the menstrual cycle for a long time, and we actually got interested in this about 25 years ago. And there are a number of self-report studies in the literature that suggest that there may be a PMS kind of syndrome in women who have MS, that they get sort of premenstrual exacerbations of their MS symptoms, not of common premenstrual symptoms. And there are only a few studies, but they're fairly consistent, and this seems to happen maybe in about, two-thirds to 75% of women. And one study has reported that aspirin might be a good way to treat this. So we know a lot about pregnancy and MS, and we know a little bit about the menstrual cycle and MS, and we know very, very little about menopause. And menopause and MS is a subject that we're just beginning to get information on. There's a little bit of information that suggests that some women with MS, when they reach menopause, may have worsening of their MS. Certainly a lot of symptoms of MS may become worse at menopause, but when you look at those symptoms, a lot of those symptoms happen in women at menopause who don't have MS. So there's clearly some overlap. Certainly women, whether they have MS or not, who are going through menopause may become more tired. As Dr. Voskel told you, MS can certainly cause cognitive problems. And again, we tend to see this in women at menopause without MS. Menopause can certainly cause bladder and sexual dysfunction, mood changes, and sleep disturbance. So there may certainly be overlap of some of these symptoms that occur in women who have MS and women at menopause, but they're all pretty treatable. So let's go back to pregnancy, because that's the area that we have the most information on, and Dr. Voskel has told us very nicely what pregnancy does to MS. What we're going to consider now is what does MS do to somebody who's pregnant, how do we handle symptom management, what about breastfeeding, and what about preventing attacks. So the good news is that MS doesn't really affect most things that we would be concerned about in pregnancy. Women and men who have MS do not have decreased rates of fertility. There's no increase in miscarriages in women who have MS. There's no increase in birth defects. There's a little data that suggests that some women who have MS may have slightly lower birth weights of their babies. Personally, all of the women that I've taken care of who've had pregnancies have had normal pregnancies and normal babies. Now, what Dr. Voskel showed us was that research tells us that during pregnancy, the relapse rate goes down by about two-thirds. There's a little bit of a spike in the relapse rate in the first 3 to 6 months postpartum, and it turns out that the best predictor of having a postpartum relapse is how active the disease was before the woman got pregnant. That is, that somebody who had very active disease, who had a lot of relapses before they became pregnant, are more likely to have a relapse in the first 3 to 6 months after the baby is born based on their pre-pregnancy relapse rate. So in those women, we may want them to resume their disease-modifying therapy sooner rather than later, And there's a couple of studies that suggest that in women who were at high risk for a relapse, that is those women who had very active disease before pregnancy, that a compound called IVIG, or intravenous immunoglobulin, may be useful in preventing postpartum relapses. When we asked the question, well, what happens to women with MS who become pregnant? Is there any effect on their MS down the line? And most of the data indicate that pregnancy does not increase long-term disability. And in fact, there's some information that suggests that women who become pregnant may actually have a slightly better course. We get asked very frequently, do I have to have women who are pregnant with MS, do they have any particular issues during labor and delivery? And what we generally say is for most women who have MS, the obstetrician would manage the labor and delivery the same way for a woman of comparable health status who didn't have MS. It's certainly okay for women with MS to have epidural anesthesia. If you have a woman who has a very, very severe sensory loss, she might not feel the contraction, she might not get the urge to push as much, so she might require a little assistance. And there's also no data that a C-section will precipitate a relapse. So, again, other than extraordinary circumstances, women with MS, their conduct of labor and delivery is pretty much the same as a woman of comparable status who doesn't have MS. As we talked about, for menopause, there are a lot of symptoms that occur during menopause that are also MS symptoms, and the same thing happens during pregnancy. Women who are pregnant who don't have MS are certainly going to have fatigue. They may have difficulty with balance and mobility, particularly later on in the pregnancy. Pregnant women certainly can have bladder symptoms, and they may have constipation. And women with MS may also have spasticity. So again, we have this overlap. Now, normally we can manage all these symptoms in a woman who's not pregnant with strategies and pharmacologic agents. We certainly tend not to use the drugs during pregnancy, and so we have to think of other ways to manage these symptoms, such as resting and frequent naps and frequent time going to the bathroom and perhaps assistive devices. The disease-modifying agents, so these are our drugs that help prevent relapses, are not indicated during pregnancy, and there's two reasons. One is because almost all of them have been associated, at least in animal models and in some human data, with increases in miscarriage or increases in birth defects. So they may be potentially dangerous to use. But as Dr. Voskel just told you, we don't need them because pregnancy itself is a very protective state, and the pregnancy itself causes a 2/3 decrease in relapses. So we do not use the disease-modifying therapies during pregnancy, and it turns out that we can't use them when the woman is breastfeeding because either we know that they pass into the milk and the baby will get it, or we don't know. So this is a decision that women sometimes have to make after the baby is born, and they have to balance their desire to breastfeed versus if they should go back on disease-modifying therapy sooner rather than later. So this is a discussion that somebody who with MS who becomes pregnant is going to want to have with her obstetrician and her neurologist before the baby is born. Also, the disease-modifying agents can stay in your body for a certain varying amounts of time. And so for planned pregnancies, for planned conceptions, we generally advise being off drug for particular periods of time depending on the specific agent. Additionally, some of the disease-modifying therapies may have effects on other hormones, other endocrine systems. So, for example, beta interferon, and the brand names of some of those drugs are Avonex or Betaseron or Rebif. That has been associated with producing some menstrual irregularity and sometimes can produce antibodies to thyroid, so you can become hypothyroid or not have enough thyroid. And a very new drug, Lemtrada, which was just approved about 6 months ago, can sometimes produce thyroid disease. So these are things to take into consideration as well. We talked a little bit about breastfeeding, and we said that right now you cannot breastfeed and take disease-modifying therapies. Up until very recently, most of the studies that had been done on breastfeeding said, well, we don't think breastfeeding has any effect on relapses. There have been a few studies over the past 2 to 3 years that have reported that in women who breastfed exclusively, meaning the baby never got a bottle, the baby never got anything but breast milk, that those women seem to have a somewhat decreased relapse rate compared to women who either didn't breastfeed or had bottles plus breastfeeding. So this is a very interesting observation. We need a little bit more information in this area. One of the questions that we get asked very frequently is, what is the risk of my child or my children having MS? We know that in general, if you have a first degree relative, meaning if your parent or your brother and sister has MS, then that person is at a higher risk than the general population, but in an absolute sense, it's very low. So it's maybe up to about 5% for a girl or a daughter, and maybe 1 to 3% for a boy. But the other way to look at it is that a child has a 95 to 99% chance of not coming down with MS. But this is a little higher than the general population. However, most people who have MS, about 80%, don't have an affected first-degree relative. So that 20% do, but about 80%, nobody in their family has MS. There is a genetic component to MS. It's an immune-mediated disease. Many components of the immune system are under genetic control, but this is an area of very intense research. We haven't worked out all the details yet. Dr. Voskal talked about men, and I'll just repeat some of that. We think that men only get MS about one-third as often as women. But when they do get it, they do tend to have more disability, and it's more common to have what we call the primary progressive form of MS. This is the least common form of MS, and it's the type that does not begin with relapses and remissions, but people have onset of symptoms or problems, and then these just kind of gradually get worse over time. They don't relapse and remit. Also, in primary progressive MS, we tend to see more nerve damage in the spinal cord as opposed to the brain. And for some reason, this tends to be a little bit more frequent in men than relapsing remitting MS, which is more common in women. And as Dr. Voskal told you, this might have something with the fact that men with MS tend to have somewhat lower testosterone levels than men who don't have MS. Both men and women who have MS can have sexual dysfunction, and I wanted to spend a minute or two about on this because what I find is that there's a little bit of don't ask, don't tell mentality about sexual dysfunction. Patients are embarrassed to tell, and quite honestly, sometimes doctors are embarrassed to ask. But I think it's important to talk about because it's very treatable. And as you can see from the slide, it's very common. About three-quarters of people who have MS can have sexual dysfunction, and sometimes it's the very first symptoms. People with MS who have sexual dysfunction also tend to have bladder symptoms. It's also been shown to correlate with mood disorders, and it's also been shown to correlate with weakness, particularly in the legs, and that makes sense because the same nerves in the spinal cord that the spinal cord pathways that control the legs can also control genitourinary dysfunction. So for women, certainly the symptoms might be decreased libido, decreased lubrication, inability to properly lubricate, decreased ability to have orgasms and pain with intercourse. And men, of course, can have decreased libido, erectile dysfunction, and they may also have numbness or abnormal genital sensation or pain. And then, of course, there are all the other MS symptoms that can also contribute to sexual dysfunction. And I have a list here, and some of them are physical, and some of them may be psychologic. And, again, I think it's important to talk about these because they're all treatable. They're all amenable to some intervention. In addition to MS symptoms that can cause, that can contribute to sexual dysfunction, and in addition to the disease that can itself cause sexual dysfunction, medications can also contribute to sexual dysfunction. And this is just a listing of some of the common classes of medications that may contribute to sexual dysfunction. And a common one, of course, is antidepressants. So if you happen to be taking antidepressant medication and there's a sexual dysfunction issue, you may have to have a conversation with that doctor and see if there's an alternative agent. So again, the take-home message here is that it's important to talk about sexual dysfunction because it's treatable. We want to try to treat anything that may be contributing to the primary sexual dysfunction, so if there's pain or fatigue or bladder problems or mood disorders, we want to treat those. In terms of drugs, pharmacologic agents to treat sexual dysfunction, you're all familiar with all of the different erectile dysfunction drugs. You can turn on the evening news and you'll get three commercials for Viagra and Cialis and all those other drugs. As we know, about a month or so ago, the FDA just approved a drug for female libido dysfunction. It hasn't been tested in women with MS, but it's going to be on the market. Certainly, we want to treat any psychologic dysfunction. And then, of course, there are mechanical devices to treat erectile dysfunction and decrease sensation. I'm going to finish up just by talking a little bit about health maintenance for both genders. Unfortunately, just because you have MS doesn't mean that you can't get breast cancer or colon cancer or hypertension or osteoporosis. And again, these are all very preventable conditions. So we would urge people with MS, just like people who don't have MS, to try to be meticulous about their health maintenance and see their health care providers. And these are a list of tests that we advise at least on an annual or every couple of year basis. And everybody always forgets dental health, but dental health is important too. And so this is my summary slide. This is my last slide. We know a lot about pregnancy and MS. We know what happens during pregnancy. We know what happens after pregnancy. We know a little bit about the menstrual cycle. A lot of women may report increase in symptoms perimenstrually. We don't know very much about menopause right now. I think that we have to treat things symptomatically. And when people ask about birth control or hormone replacement, we say right now we have no information that hormones are bad for women with MS. We certainly have data based on the work of researchers like Dr. Vosko that some hormones may be very good for MS. And so we think hormone treatment should be made on gynecologic rather than neurologic grounds. And I'm going to stop and I guess turn it over to the moderator and take questions for Dr. Vosko and me.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Geiser. So before we move into the question and answer portion of today's presentation, I just want to draw attention to everybody to the additional resources slide that's on the screen. These are additional publications, videos, et cetera, that we have available so that you can dive a little bit deeper on some of what we've talked about this evening. And so now we're going to go ahead and start the Q&A portion. For those of you who've been posing questions on the chat feature, I have been tracking on them and we'll work them through the Q&A. We will open up the phone lines in just a minute and take phone questions as well. And so, LaPortia, if you will instruct us on how to ask questions for those on the phone, we can go ahead and begin the Q&A portion.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star, then the number one. We'll pause for a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Okay, and while we queue up some of the phone lines, Dr. Geiser and Dr. Vosko, I'm going to go ahead and start with some of the questions from the chat feature. So the first question comes from Kevin, and he is inquiring whether the thought is that MS can reduce testosterone or testosterone can cause MS or vice versa. Any thoughts on that?
Yes, actually, this is Dr. Vosko. A lot of thoughts on that. There are two pieces of evidence that would – he's right in the sense that it's the chicken or the egg, and it could be either one. That's a very good question. To address this, there have been a couple things that have been done, clinical and preclinical. So at the preclinical level, we do the MS animal model. That's sometimes why you do it, because you can answer those sort of questions because you can intervene. And as I said, we actually took away testosterone or made them have low levels, and indeed that made the disease worse. So that argues for causality. Second thing, on the clinical level, there's a very large consortium that just completed a study in the UK. And what they found when they looked back at records from patients that dated very far back, even before they had MS, they noted that the people who had low testosterone levels then had an increased likelihood to get MS later. And so both of those together would suggest or support the probability that the argument would be that low testosterone levels predispose to getting MS.
Okay. Dr. Geiser, did you want to add anything?
No.
Okay. All right. So then I'm going to go ahead and pose another question from the chat feature. This one is from Teresa, and she's wondering about thoughts, anything from a research perspective in terms of treatment ideas for patients with MS that are already going through menopause.
Okay. So the that question actually relates to another one that came up as well that I see, which was how much estriol was given.
Mm-hmm.
And these are very much related to the answer that to the question about how much was given is in our trials, the two trials that we completed, and as well as we have another one that is now ongoing. In all three of those trials, we gave 8 milligrams a day. The reason that we gave it was because it had been given safely previously, and also because we knew that it caused a mid-pregnancy level in the blood. Now, that in contrast to the dose of estriol that is usually used for menopause in non-MS women throughout Europe and Asia for literally decades, that dose is 1 to 2 milligrams a day, and it is for 6 months duration. What we did is we were trying to recapitulate the pregnancy issue, and that was to give them a higher dose, a dose of pregnancy, and that's 8 milligrams. Now, this also goes back to what Dr. Geiser had said about oral contraceptives. I agree with her that the data show that oral contraceptives are not bad, and I don't think they're good. I don't think they have really any major effect on MS. And the reason is because there are very low levels, and they're fluctuating levels. They're low levels. Some contain no estrogen. Some contain estrogen at certain weeks. And on top of all that, they're very low levels. And so the key is to treat with a high enough dose to recapitulate pregnancy. But you can only do that with certain estrogens, ones that are safe. And so the important point here is that all estrogens are not alike. Estriol is different than some of the other ones, both in safety and probably in efficacy. So the bottom line is we use estriol at 8 milligrams a day to give a mid-pregnancy level, and that is higher than what's generally used to control hot flashes and other menopausal symptoms, which is only 1 to 2 milligrams.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, another question from the chat, and this one is from Kara. She's wondering whether neurologists will prescribe testosterone for men who have low levels of testosterone, or is that something that an endocrinologist needs to treat?
Okay, so right now I think it's important to appreciate that this is still at the research level, and it's actually at the early level. So with research in MS, you have preclinical studies, which are animal model source studies or lab bench studies. You have a phase one, which is for toxicity. Now, the beauty of that is with both estriol and testosterone, there's a lot known on safety already. So we're not going to start all over with just toxicity to liver, kidney, et cetera. That's a good thing. Next thing that you do is you do a phase two study where it's a small group of patients, like 10, is what we did. And that's been done for testosterone and estriol. The next thing you do is you do over 100. That's a large phase two trial. And the last thing that you do for FDA approval is you do a phase three trial. A phase three trial has not been done in estriol, although a large phase two has been done. With testosterone, we got our a rejection from the NIH to do that. There wasn't apparently enough funding to do the phase two large trial for testosterone in men. So it's too early. And that's why Dr. Geiser was saying usually you treat based on their gynecologic or their androgenic needs and not MS, because it hasn't been proven yet. These large phase 3 trials have not yet been done in MS. And so really people shouldn't be taking estriol or testosterone for their MS because it simply hasn't been proven yet. We need to do larger, longer studies. And there's one more that needs to be done with estriol, and there's two more that need to be done with testosterone before people can start taking it for their MS.
Okay. All right. LaPortia, do you have some calls queued up from the phone lines? And first names only, please, when introducing the callers.
Yes, ma'am. And you do have a question from the line of Jerry.
Yes, my question. I am a female veteran. Have you done any studies on women veterans that were in combat and exposed environmental effects? I was in Desert Shield, Desert Storm in the 90s, and after I get back in 91, I went through a series of events and finally was diagnosed with MS in 1999. And my period ended in 99. But, however, in June of 2000, I had one more period, and then, of course, I'm postmenopausal. I'm 59. So my question is, have you studied female veterans that have been in combat and been exposed to environmental factors within and then develop MS? Thank you.
I haven't done any studies. Dr. Geiser can say whether she has. I would say that there is quite a bit of data about stress and MS, and stress is there are many types. There's acute stress, there's chronic stress, and it is an immune disease, and stress can affect the immune system. And so one wouldn't know if you were exposed to chronic or acute stress, and that could have somehow predisposed to MS. I would argue, though, however, that it could have just been a not necessarily causally linked circumstance. I've seen several women in the clinic who've come in and they're 50 or over and their periods are ending and they have their first episode of MS. So, and they were not veterans and they didn't have that stress experience. So we don't really know if those two are related or not. Dr. Geiser, do you have any comment on that?
I would just echo what you ended with. I don't think we have enough information in this area.
Okay. LaPortia, another question from the phone line.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star, then one. We'll pause for a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Okay, I've got another question from the chat feature in the meantime. What is your treatment recommendation for postmenopausal women?
I would clarify the question a little bit. Are we talking about treating menopausal symptoms or MS symptoms? And as I pointed out, you can have an overlap. So if somebody is having symptoms that are a direct result of menopause, or more likely to be due to the menopause, like the hot flashes and things like that, then I would advise talking about treatment for that with your gynecologist. Again, some of these symptoms, fatigue and bladder issues, may overlap. Hormonal treatment might resolve some of those, but there are other drugs and other strategies that we would use to address those symptoms in somebody who's not menopausal. So you may need a combination of the two.
Okay. LaPortia, are there any other questions on the phone line?
And there are no further questions over the phone line.
Okay. I've got one more question from the chat feature that is not exactly related to the topic today, but we'll go ahead and give it a whirl. There's a question on here in terms of whether there are any ongoing studies that look at differences in MS related to race. Can either of you comment on that? To race? Ethnicity?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
There are studies. It's very interesting because there's some evidence that there could be differences in the rate of disability progression or even which disabilities are affected. And most of the studies to date are focused on the genetics of, in other words, the initial studies focused on MS versus normal. And now I think some of the genetic studies are subdividing the MS group between Caucasian, African American, Latin American, Asian. And so, yes, I think there's a lot of interest in that. Exactly.
I just got another question, and we still have a couple minutes left, so I'm going to try and get it in. Is there any data as to whether the 8 milligram of estradiol is safe for women who have had strokes due to clots from contraceptives containing high estrogen levels? Does that make sense? Do you need me to repeat it?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. It's a good question. Okay. The question is, it dates back to the very long history of people realizing that even young women who smoke and take birth control pills are more likely to have strokes. And so there is definitely an element of increased clotting that's known to be associated with estrogens, and that's why I said they're not all alike. And there is evidence that this clotting is mediated through this estrogen receptor alpha and not beta, and estriol binds beta more than alpha, but that said, estriol does bind alpha to some degree. The evidence is that it's safer than the others, but I personally would not recommend taking an estrogen or testosterone in anybody who'd had cardiovascular risk, because I don't think it's been proven yet, and I think that that's, you may be prone to getting clotting. So I would say no to estriol in somebody who's had previous cardiovascular disease.
And I think when we did our trial, if I recall, things like a history of clotting and smoking were exclusionary factors.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, you'll see that in most trials with MS. If they've had a history of significant other neurologic diseases, they'll be excluded. But you're right. This is particularly salient with respect to hormones. I will say, though, however, to put this into context, we are all very concerned. Testosterone also can cause clotting in men, and it causes elevated hemoglobin levels, just as, you know, birth control pills can cause clotting in women, particularly those who smoke. So these are concerning elements of hormones, but my perspective that I wanted to take away with, or for you to take away with, would be that I think when you think about the risk of taking, for example, at the worst case scenario, birth control pills or testosterone, those drugs actually we do know a lot about, and they're pretty safe. They're so safe that even the healthy population uses them really often. And so I think to have an MS drug, a disease that can be potentially disabling, to have an MS drug that falls within the range of a drug that's taken by healthy individuals for, say, birth control or for testosterone in otherwise healthy men, I think we're at a pretty good range, actually, with this risk-benefit ratio of a drug that's that safe. Most of the MS disease-modifying treatments that are used and are available out there now for MS have much more deleterious effects than some of these things that we're talking about with respect to risks.
All right. LaPortia, any other phone questions?
Yes, ma'am. You do have a question from the line of Debbie.
Okay.
This is a way off the wall question, but have we tried testosterone in women?
That's actually not way off the wall. It's a good question. And we thought a lot about that. We've tried you go back to the preclinical mouse model and you ask, could it work? It may or may not work because they may not have the appropriate estrogen receptor for the estrogen to work in men, or they may not have the appropriate androgen receptor for it to work conversely. So it's a good question, and we've done that, and other groups have done this, and we've shown that estriol treatment can work in male mice with DMS disease, and that testosterone clearly works in female mice with the disease. The reason I haven't done that is because there are not widespread usages of testosterone in women like testosterone in men, and there are not widespread usages of estrogen in men the way you have testosterone in men. So I've tried on the first pass to to tailor these hormones to something that will actually be desirable and not undesirable with respect to side effects. Women feel good when they take estriol. Men feel good when they take testosterone. The converse won't necessarily be true. Women could have hirsutism. They could have hair growth, or they could have hoarseness. Men could have some breast enlargement. So we've tried to focus on using the hormone that is best tailored to the other general side effects that patients might undergo. But you're absolutely right. Theoretically, it could work and it could be done.
Thank you.
Okay. Great. All right. So that concludes the question and answer portion. I do have a couple of survey questions that I'm about to put on your screen, some polling questions. So if you will take a moment to click on the center of your screen and submit your results. Are you a partner, a family member, or a person with MS? Please click the answer on the center of your screen. Okay. Next question, was the material presented this evening relevant to you, yes or no? Please click your response on the center of your screen. Okay. Next question, were the speakers and the information they presented easy to understand? Please select your response in the center of your screen. Last question, did you learn something new from this presentation? Yes or no? Please select your answer in the center of your screen. And that concludes today's presentation. I want to thank Dr. Oswald and Dr. Geischer for joining us this evening and putting together such a fascinating presentation. Just a reminder, if you would like to hear this again or know anyone who missed today's presentation, it was recorded and is available on our website along with a copy of the actual slide deck. So please make sure that you check that out. I put that web address in the chat feature, and it was also in all of the confirmation materials that you received. So thank you all for joining us this evening. This concludes the presentation. Have a wonderful night.